Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. We live in a digital age. Increasingly, we conduct our daily business online, things like banking, shopping, planning our routes, and even entertaining ourselves with cat videos and the like. For doctors, the push to digital sometimes has the feeling of being on a Japanese bullet train with no means of getting off. Our medical record systems have all become digitized in the last 5 years. No more scrawling in paper charts, now we point and click our way through patient visits. We order tests and correspond with colleagues online. No big deal, you say, welcome to the modern world. But the medical profession, which values tradition, has always been slow to leave behind 19th century totems like the stethoscope. Layer on top of this technology reluctance the whole issue of social media. Do you use Facebook, Twitter, or other so-called platforms? Your doctor might in her personal life, but why would she want to create an online presence for her practice? My guest today is someone who champions the value of physicians creating such online presences. He sees doctors as having the ability to curate content for their audiences, whether patients, real or virtual, or to benefit the general public. Brian Vartabedian is a pediatric gastroenterologist at Texas Children's Hospital and a faculty member at the Baylor College of Medicine. He's the man behind the popular blog 33 Charts and the author of the recent ebook called The Public Physician: Practical Wisdom for Life in a Connected, Always-On World. Vartabedian is visiting Tulsa, where this afternoon he'll be delivering a workshop entitled The Public Professional on the OU Tulsa campus. Brian Vartabedian, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I want to start by asking you what you mean by the term public physician. Aren't all physicians public in a sense if they're in practice and open to patients?
Yeah, well, I guess a public physician is someone who takes information and translates it for the general public or general public consumption. You know, all this is a function of the fact that we now have all these social tools available to us, Twitter and Facebook and blogs. And for the better part of medical history, physicians just had interaction with patients one-on-one in an exam room. But now that we have all these amazing tools of what we call democratized media, we can actually, as physicians, make media just like you're doing here as a physician.
Yes, you notice it. So you are, I would say, almost an evangelist for this concept. I mean, what has led you to this type of advocacy? I mean, you're essentially teaching other doctors how to relish their role or to become curators of content.
Yeah. Well, I guess it kind of starts with my history. I began on this journey in 2006 when I wrote a book for parents called Colic Solved. And at the time, I started a blog because all of my author friends said, in order to sell your book, you have to have a blog. So I said, great, I'll have a blog and I'll have it for 6 months and it'll be a gimmick and I'll sell lots of books and sail into the sunset. So not long after the blog went up, I wrote a post on, this is in 2006, I think, on how Nestle and Gerber had merged. And so I just wrote a little post for parents on how this is going to change the way we feed babies. Well, it got picked up by one of the European financial feeds, and my traffic went nuts. And I realized at that point that this platform that I was on that was just a gimmick for selling books is really an amazing tool, an amazing platform, and it was kind of a transformational moment for me. And so realizing that and realizing the power and strength of public media and social media, I kind of took on the cause on some level of helping doctors understand the power and value of being public and being present in front of patients. And there's an advantage for patients too.
Okay. So, you know, I also am a blogger and I do find that my colleagues sometimes say, oh gosh, you know, Facebook and Twitter, those, you know, nothing but harm can befall me there. Why should a doctor, and I know you get this question a lot, why should they have a public presence or why should they be on Twitter, Facebook? Or what they often will say is, I'm so busy. I don't have time for this.
Right. You know, what you're getting at is basically this tension that happens with doctors when they think about using these, and it's between risk and opportunity. And doctors always look at public media from the perspective of the risk. They're worried about all the bad things that can happen, but they forget the tremendous opportunity they can create for themselves and for their patients by being public. So whenever I talk to doctors and who have that argument, I always kind of shape the advantages of having a public visibility and being present both in terms of your business and in terms of shaping health literacy. And it's also reaching a point where not being present in the public space is almost weird. And what I mean by that is millennial parents, I'm a pediatrician, the first thing they do when they're looking for a pediatrician is they Google them to see what they're all about. And if you can't find anything, it's reached a point where that's almost a liability. So we can say that participation is optional, but so is relevance. So if you want to be in touch with the times as a physician, you want to be present and out there so your patients can see what you look like and how you think.
So a lot of doctors nowadays are parts of big organizations. So increasingly, interestingly, increasingly, as we've seen medicine become digitized, electronic health records, et cetera, we've also seen a consolidation to where fewer and fewer doctors are out under their own shingle out in practice. So if I work for a big organization, a hospital system, an academic health center, you know, a large physician group, you know, help me think through what's my obligation. Am I speaking for my institution, or do I need clearance from up above? Should I still be maintaining my own individuality, so to speak, online, or should I just let the professionals handle it?
Well, this is kind of an evolving problem for physicians as they go into this space. And you brought the point right that a lot of doctors are now employees. They work for these big hospital systems, and deciding where we fit into that can be a real challenge. Also, it's becoming increasingly difficult for doctors to separate their personal and their professional lives. So I always advocate doctors that they have their own presence, because they may not live under the same umbrella for all their career, so they want to be able to take their digital identity with them. So they can still serve as a brand ambassador for University of Tulsa or OU, while at the same time kind of representing themselves. But it is a real challenge about who we really represent.
You addressed this earlier. You said millennial parents particularly are going to look for their physician on Google. What about, let's say, the general patient, or perhaps the older patient who's not as, you've used this term digitally native. So I guess I'll first ask you to define what you mean by digitally native versus, is it digital immigrant?
Yeah.
Sort of the converse of that?
Yeah.
Why should patients who are perhaps digital immigrants care about whether their doctor has a social media presence? And you've sort of alluded to that, but let me ask you.
Well, you know, I mean, some of the older generation may not care, quite honestly, but increasingly healthcare consumers are becoming more engaged with online content. My parents recently passed away, but they had no concern for this, and they never used the internet. And so for them, it was completely irrelevant. But increasingly for millennial parents, this is just the way we engage with information. It's the way we collect information. And patients frequently try to reach us on platforms like Facebook and Twitter. Not often, but we as physicians think it's so weird that a mom would try to do that. But in reality, that's the way young mothers communicate. These are the platforms they're on.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Our guest today is Brian Vartabedian. He's a physician and a blogger. Blog is called 33 Charts. He's also the author of an ebook entitled The Public Physician, Practical Wisdom for a Life in a Connected, Always-On World. And so you've been blogging, you've said, for a number of years. What led you to write this ebook? You mentioned, too, that you had authored, I think, a book about colic originally, sort
yeah.
of in print and more in line with kind of what you had
right.
as a pediatric gastroenterologist. I mean,
right.
solving colic would be should be a bestseller, right?
Yeah, right. It's done pretty well. It's still in print after 2006. But, you know, so I started my first blog after writing that book, realized that this was really a platform to the future, got into Twitter in 2008. And as one of the earlier physicians in Twitter at that time, issues started to appear as more and more doctors started to appear in what I call the public space on Twitter. And people were asking questions like, can you communicate with another patient on Twitter? Can you answer a question? Can you answer a general question? You know, all these things started to come up. And so I started a blog called 33 Charts, which kind of addresses a lot of the issues that doctors are facing in this new world. And since 2008, I covered a lot of these issues, and I thought it would be a good time to take all the advice for doctors on how to kind of live in this new public world and put it all together in one book. So it's a lot of advice for docs, and some patients may find it interesting too.
So you use this term a lot in your blog, and I've read through some posts, curation, so that doctors – in a sense, or any sort of public professional, someone with specialized knowledge who has an online presence acts as a curator of sorts. And
yeah.
is that, I think of a curator as someone who curates paintings in a museum. This goes a little bit beyond that.
Yeah, so curation is just one way that we can process information. And so curation is the collection of information around a certain theme, typically with human sensibility. For example, you can use a computer algorithm that a lot of us do to collect news information, but that's computer-driven and it's all just dumped in. Curation is something where we take our human values and judgments and we make a list of things. And so the reason curation, say, on a blog is so important is because one of the challenges that patients are facing here in the information age, even doctors, is the fact that we're seeing and experiencing so much information. In fact, information has become the problem rather than the solution. And so one of the ways that we can help healthcare consumers is to use our knowledge and expertise as physicians and consolidated information. We can come up with the 10 best sites, for example, for patients with celiac disease, so that a patient can look at me as a trusted source and say, oh, these are reliable sources. So curation is evolving as a very important type of content creation or media creation for physicians online.
And you dabble in that world. I mean, you still give health information out as well sometimes, but most of the time you spend your focus and energy on sort of talking about or writing about or thinking about curation, content, brand presence. I mean, it's quite interesting. So it's almost like your day job is still as a pediatric gastroenterologist.
Absolutely.
And it's like you spend maybe the rest of your time, and I know you educate, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit, but coursework, you teach, you lecture, you keynote speak. Mm-hmm. You're really kind of a champion of this.
So, you know, I started my world in public as a freelance writer during fellowship and residency. I wrote for magazines because I could earn more money than I could working in the ER. And so I've always had a love for translating information for patients, and that's what my first blog was. But you're right, I get sidetracked into this world of technology and doctors, and it's been an exciting journey. And it kind of illustrates what we're seeing with doctors. We always assume that the only thing a physician can do is translate health information to a fourth grade level. You know, we assume that when a doctor has a blog, it's going to be about some health information. But there's lots of things that physicians can do. Advocacy, government relations, and there's all kinds of things that doctors can do beyond creating health information. And so I'm just one example of that.
When I blog, I think about sort of the meta-medical. I think there's many better people out there who can actually deliver the actual health content. But the things I like to look at are, as you point out, the policy or the finances of healthcare, all these things that are so complicated.
Exactly.
That even as doctors we struggle with, and yet we want to sort of understand them better for our patients.
And that's a great role that we can play because we have a lot of expertise in that. And there's so many passions that we all have as physicians, but we kind of get restricted by this idea that all we can think about is patients. And patients are really important, and we can play a real role there, but there's other things we can do.
So your blog is really polished. Like, it has just a nice, clean look. It's very readable. And I noticed, too, early on in your blogging career, you posted frequently. I mean, every day, sometimes even maybe multiple times a day. And now it's much more less frequent, probably because you're doing these other things. But also, I think I noticed on the blog, you changed it sort of from pure blog to kind of sandbox of ideas. And I don't know if that just means it addresses some of the less frequency. But I guess what I wanted to ask you, were there obstacles along the way? You started it as a parenting blog about the book, and it morphed into this 33 charts, which is really all about physicians and everything, their online presence, social media, content curation. What were some of the obstacles along the journey?
Well, just in terms of the sandbox, I just want to touch on the sandbox of ideas issues, because it's interesting as I'll put ideas that I'm thinking about out there that aren't fully formed. And one of the nice things about that is other people will find you and tell you what they're doing. And so it's one of the nice things about this world we have where we can sort of publish things on our own. And so that's created real opportunities for me. When you're visible, people find you, and people find you, things happen. And so there have been circumstances where that's certainly been the case. In terms of your question about obstacles, probably the biggest obstacle, interestingly, early on in the mid-2000s was what my employer would think. Right now, it's just second nature that a physician can have a blog and public presence. But in the mid-2000s, starting a blog was a little racy. In fact, most of the physicians, when they first were starting blogs, many of them were anonymous. Grunt Doc, Dr. Anonymous, some of them have disappeared. But everybody was afraid they were going to get fired for having their own opinion. And it just kind of illustrates how cloistered we are in medicine and how we have this culture of permission that we can only do things when somebody asks us to or we're given permission. And so that was probably the biggest obstacle, was figuring out how to approach my employer. So I just did it, told my employer, and what I've done all along is always said to my chairman and my boss that, listen, just look at my stuff. If there's anything you don't like, just tell me. Because I do recognize that despite the fact that it's my own blog, I'm still a brand ambassador for Texas Children's and Baylor College of Medicine, right? So I'm aware of that, and I see that as a responsibility to my community. Despite the fact that I have this power to publish this stuff, I still have a responsibility to my peers and my professional peers.
So the big question then is, has your chair or your boss ever come to you and said, hey, I don't like what you wrote? Or, I mean, are you hewing to a line where that doesn't occur too much?
I'm probably hewing to a line where it doesn't occur. Number one, I talk about technology, which isn't that controversial. And number two, I'm pretty safe and I think I'm relatively smart. I think if I were writing about politics or abortion politics and I were an OB-GYN, you're looking at some real issues there with an institution and how it's represented in public, because half the world is not going to like it. The other half is going to like it.
You teach in a variety of ways to students and residents and established physicians, but also certainly non-physicians, because I know you're, as part of the tech community, you're talking to people where it's sort of unsiloed. You know, you're talking to other folks in the tech space. And so, you know, how and why do you use social media, many other things. But in fact, you've started a MOOC, M-O-O-C, which stands for Massive Open Online Course. And I love the name of another course you've developed called Digital Smarts for students at Baylor College of Medicine. So what are those experiences like? Are those I guess, something in constant evolution?
Let me just touch upon one comment you made a minute or so back, which is the idea that I interface with non-physicians and the tech community. I think that's really important, and I've discovered and learned that some of the best solutions in medicine can come from outside of our silo. And if you look in other industries, really smart people look outside of their space for solutions that have been solved in other places. And I think a lot of the issues that we're facing in healthcare have been confronted and faced in the consumer and retail world and others. But be it as it may, I really enjoy dealing with people outside of medicine. But you're absolutely right. I've done some teaching, and I co-taught a course at Rice University called Medicine in the Digital Age, and we converted it into a MOOC, or a massive open online course, that went live in May. And the course was really all about this transformation of medicine from this old analog style age to this new modern digital age, and all the things that we're facing, all the things that have fueled it. And we had about 9,000 students.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, it's a lot of students to look after, and we used peer assessments, so the students assessed themselves with their projects. And what was amazing was we had students from all over the world, from Fiji, from Iran, and from all over Africa. And what's so remarkable about these online courses through edX and Coursera is the fact that people in the third world can have access to all this amazing information, and that was probably the most fun part of it.
And were all of, not clearly, and I know from other massive open online courses, not all students that do sign up and take the course don't do it for credit, but were there credit-seeking students, like locally at Rice, that were?
That's very interesting, because the course was originally offered as a four-credit course at Rice, and we converted it into a MOOC, but students couldn't get credit for that MOOC. But what you're bringing up is a point that's sort of in evolution, which is, can students and universities get credits for these MOOCs, and that's something that's being talked about.
Now, this other course, Digital Smarts, is it for med students who are about to enter into the real world as they go off into residency, or is it for residents who are about to go off into the real world?
It's both. So we've talked about this transition of the physician from this siloed space into this new world where we all have a smartphone and we all have text messaging immediately available to us. And what we're seeing is these students who are coming into medical school and residency are digital natives. They were born and raised with the internet. And so they're used to real-time communication and dialogue, and they land on the wards with a smartphone and a camera. It's a recipe for disaster, and we've all seen that. And as of right now, undergraduate medical education has not even addressed the issues, not even faced it.
And this, when you say undergraduate, I just want to clarify for listeners, that's
medical school. Yeah, undergraduate medical education. So when a student goes to medical school, they have absolutely zero education on how to have any of this dialogue in the public area, how to use Twitter, how to be safe with it. And so at Baylor College of Medicine, we started a sequence of lectures and interactive workshops called Digital Smarts, and it brings students from their first day of orientation right through graduation. Early on, we teach them how not to be a jackass as a doctor, as a medical student with a smartphone. And when they graduate, we are really kind of telling them how they can use LinkedIn and Twitter to build their personal learning network and build their career.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher today. Our guest, Brian Vartabedian, he's a physician and a blogger. He writes the blog 33 Charts, also author of an ebook entitled The Public Physician, Practical Wisdom for Life in a Connected, Always-On World. Dr. Vartabedian is going to be holding a seminar later today at OU Tulsa on a topic we're calling the public professional, where he's going to be working with a multifaceted audience really to kind of help with some of these areas of content curation and professional identity on the internet. We were talking about digital smarts, essentially how to get medical students to the digital natives, as it were, to use their digital tools for good. They've been using these as throughout their adolescence now and into early adulthood. Are there examples that you might give very briefly for radio of things gone awry? Or I think you have a story, too, of a sort of a digital media, social media spat
snafu,
you got into,
yeah.
A snafu. Is that something you could share?
Well, yeah. And in terms of students, I mean, there are lots of cases where students have gotten into small bits of trouble and we sort of try to intercept. And the problem is we can't follow every medical student's social media feed. And so usually when it comes to our attention, it's too late. But like I said, we're trying to educate these students before bad things happen. But in terms of my own world, I made this transition over the past 8 years or so. And there was one instance where there was an anesthesiologist in the Midwest who was anonymous. Again, this is an anonymous physician. And she used to narrate in a very crude way her experiences with patients. She would make fun of obese patients. It was really horrendous. And so one day in my blog, I called her out. And it led to this big meltdown on Twitter. All the physicians thought I was kind of unjust by calling her out and doing it in this way. And it led to this huge dialogue about what responsibility we have as physicians in public to call each other out on unprofessional behavior. And the young medical students thought I should have asked her first. And my argument was, well, she was anonymous. How can I ask an anonymous person their permission? So this has been used as sort of a case study, an ethics case study by the Cleveland Clinic and others. And so there have been other cases like that where I've run into little problems. But we write ourselves. We're learning how to exist in this new space. And there are new rules and new responsibilities we have. There may even be an ethical obligation for physicians to be out there.
Say more about that.
Or a moral obligation. So the example I like to give is the issue of vaccines and autism. So about 15 years ago, Andrew Wakefield was a British physician. He published a fraudulent article that linked the MMR vaccine with autism. And so what happened is over the course of the next decade, when a young mother who searched vaccines and autisms on Google, she would see the shrill voice of this vocal minority making this connection between vaccines and autism, led to all these myths and all this hysteria. But if you look during that time period, there were 65,000 pediatricians in the American Academy of Pediatrics, and had each of those 65,000 doctors just created a little bit of content, made a little podcast just like you're doing here, made a comment on a blog or written a blog post, we would have completely ruled the search engines. So I always like to use that example as one where physicians have a moral obligation to be out there as part of the conversation and correcting some of the misinformation that's out there.
That was a very – right. I mean, that belief still persists. But I mean, we've seen – MMR stands for measles, mumps, rubella. And of course, if you follow the news at all, there was a measles outbreak in the United States over the last year where people died from a controllable disease.
Absolutely. And what was interesting about this time around is there were far more pediatricians involved in the public dialogue. There was a hashtag, I think it was SB 217 was the bill in California. And there was a whole hashtag around it. And so we were all able to participate in the conversation and sway public opinion, and the bill got passed that it's mandatory before entering school. The kids have their vaccinations. So it's a good example of how it might have happened without public presence, but it was still interesting to see it evolve.
One thing I've always wondered is about the name 33 Charts. And I did a little digging, and I found out, but how is that name? What did it originally mean, and I guess why has it stuck?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's written anywhere, so it would be interesting. I don't know that you could find it if you dug around, but back when I first started the blog, I didn't know what to name it, and I used to sit in my office and late at night and complete my electronic medical records. And with some of my buddies, there weren't very many physicians on Twitter at the time, I would just count down how many charts I had left. We don't do that anymore on Twitter, but so I wrote 33 charts one night and I needed a name and I just thought.
So there were 33 charts left?
There were 33 charts left that I had to finish. So,
holy cow.
I was behind a day or two.
Okay.
Maybe I shouldn't be disclosing this. So.
Well, it's all ancient history, but the name obviously is you went viral with that. You mentioned the European financial markets with
yes.
the Nestle thing, and so once you have that name out there,
yeah,
it's stuck.
Yeah, you know, and having a different name can work for you or against you. You know, it's a little bit cryptic, but it's kind of fun.
I think of you not only as an evangelist for technology itself, but as for physicians being in the public space. But I think of you as a futurist. And I really enjoy your blog post because I'm not an early adopter of most technologies. But I really enjoy when you write about which new technologies are going to last and which aren't. And in fact, I think in a most recent example is you wrote about the Fitbit. So tell us what the Fitbit is and why you think it doesn't have, it's not going to, it's going to basically be relegated to the museum of technological history.
Or the hula hoop of digital health, as I like to call it.
Okay, the hula hoop. There you go.
Yeah, you know, I think what's happening increasingly, patients are taking control of what's happening in their bodies. And there's a movement called the quantified self movement, which is when patients take a real interest in measuring and recording what's happening in their bodies. The earliest iteration of that was step counting. So, and we've been counting steps for a generation or so, but the digital step counter has really empowered people to take control of their health. The problem is the human body is composed of more outputs than just the number of steps we take. There's heartbeat, there's impedance or sweat on the skin, and there's emotions, and there's all kinds of things we can measure. And going forward, we're going to find that there are going to be sensors in our body that will be able to record and measure things that are happening. And with the help of software and perhaps with physicians, we'll be able to make sense of all these things that are happening in our bodies almost in real time. So when I wrote that post suggesting that Fitbit was going to kind of go the way of the hula hoop, I was suggesting that the days of just wearing a wristband to measure steps is going to become antiquated once we start measuring all these other things in our bodies.
And did you say we'll have sensors? I want to clarify. You said on our bodies or in our bodies? Or were you being...
Well, I didn't say that, but now that you mentioned it, it's quite conceivable that we could have small implantable devices that can assess and measure for MI before it ever happens. Eric Topol wrote a great book called The Creative Destruction of Medicine, where he details this entire move into how we'll be monitoring our body, and we'll even have check engine lights that will tell us when things have gone awry. So it's an interesting future, and this is the most exciting time to be in medicine. I mean, things have really been fairly static in the past couple hundred years. Yeah, there have been big advances in anesthesia and pain control, but we're about to see an escalation and change and metamorphosis in medicine unlike we've ever seen before. It's really exciting to be part of it.
And what's the – is it the internet itself, or is it the ability to kind of tabulate and then analyze huge data sets like the genome, for example, or sort of all of those things in a perfect storm coming together at the same time? And I know it's not a fair question, but
– yeah, perfect storm. You know, access to information, the advance of mobile technology, the advance of sensors and software to be able to analyze and make sense of it. So the number of forces that are going to kind of drive this revolution, the internet's just a small piece of it. That's the information side, which I think is really interesting, but that's a small part of it.
The name of the blog is 33 Charts. He's also the author of an ebook entitled The Public Physician, Practical Wisdom for Life in a Connected, Always-On World. Brian Vardabedian is a pediatric gastroenterologist at Texas Children's Hospital and a member of the faculty at the Baylor College of Medicine. Brian Vardabedian, thank you so much for being here.
That's great. And if anybody wants the book, it's available on iTunes or iBooks.
And for... free.
For free.
For free.
Can't beat that.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, that's our show for today. Studio Tulsa on Health is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed by our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.